Hello, listeners. This is Cody Stark, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Standing Post. I had the recent honor to talk to another living hero who is currently a special agent in the Secret Service. He was awarded the Medal of Honor on October 1st, 2018, while serving as a senior medical sergeant assigned to the Special Forces Operational Detachment Alpha 3336, Special Operations Task Force 33, in support of Operation Enduring Freedom in Shock Valley, Afghanistan, on 6 April 2008. As a warning, our guests will discuss and share the accounts of what happened that day. So we want to warn you that there is some mild graphic content during this episode. For more information about the Secret Service or how to join, please visit www.secretservice.gov. Now, please welcome to the show, Special Agent Ronald J. Scherr. Sir, welcome to Standing Post. Would you please introduce yourself to the listeners?
My name is Ronald Scherr. I'm a special agent with the Secret Service, a counter assault team. And before that, I guess I was in the Army for a few years.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into your background and what you've done for the Army and for the Secret Service. But one of the things I always like to do with the guests that come on here each month is just to kind of get a background of where you came from, who you were, just to maybe give us some hometown pride. So where do you call home?
I call Washington State home. I was an Air Force brat growing up, so I was born in Alaska and then did, you know, the Air Force thing. We moved to Illinois, Idaho, and then ended up landing in Washington State. So that's kind of where I call home. Went through junior high, high school, college, all of that there.
Okay. And was it your mother or father that served?
Both were actually in the Air Force. That's where they met. They met in the Air Force, and Dad ended up doing 20 years and retiring with the Air Force. My mom did a few years and then got out and went on to other things.
Okay. Were they officers or enlisted?
Both were on the enlisted side.
Okay. And what did you do during like your high school and college years?
As far as like for fun things, I was a weird kid growing up, so I got really into like bicycle racing, like road racing like that. So I was a weird kid doing like 300 miles a week on bike and then doing racing every time I could. Definitely got me set up well for things in my future, I think, getting used to just being out there alone and slightly miserable for hours and hours on end. But yeah, I did that. I did the swim team, the usual things.
Okay, so, I mean, you're two parts away from a triathlon. Did you?
I did triathlons, too. Okay. I didn't get as into those, but I did those for a while and then switched over to mostly just bike racing. It just clicked for me for some reason.
Before the Secret Service, you joined the military. Can you kind of set that up and kind of set the stage about how you got into the service?
How I got into the military service?
Yes.
It was kind of a roundabout way that I ended up getting in. So I was at Washington State University in early 2001 and was trying to figure out what I was going to do. I was finishing up with a bachelor's in business economics, just given my family history of service. You know, my great-grandfather had served in World War I. My grandfather had served in World War II. Mm-hmm. My father and mother had both served. Was just kind of looking for some way to serve. So I actually tried to join the Marines as an officer in early 2001 and went through that process. Ended up getting selected to start the officer candidate school in October of 2001. But in August, as I was kind of finishing that process, my medical background kind of flagged with the selection board. I'd been hit by a car back in 1995 while I was riding a bike, and ended up spending a day in the hospital and had pancreatitis, which usually is something severe, some kind of severe medical issue or indication of drug or alcohol abuse, none of which applied to me. It was just I was hit by a car. But in August 2001, there was nothing going on. So they were like, thanks, but no thanks. Have a nice day. So I ended up starting graduate school in that time frame. Of course, a couple weeks later, September 11th happened. And so I was in graduate school kind of watching as Afghanistan started to develop, and just didn't feel right to just stay on the sidelines watching that. So started looking around for some other military branch that might might take me, and the Army was more than happy to take me, so ended up joining with the Army in 2002, and joined there as a medic.
And where do the medics go for their basic training and advanced training?
So I ended up going through Fort Jackson for my basic training, and then advanced individual training for medic is down at Fort Sam Houston.
Okay.
So spent 4 months down in San Antonio, basically learning how to be a medic. Went off to airborne school. Yeah.
Being a combat medic, is it something that you just kind of, is it a pipeline to go to airborne, or do you choose to do that?
So I chose to go to the airborne school, and one point there I actually had a ranger contract as well.
Okay.
To try and go over there. Unfortunately, because of the previous issues I had with the Marines, they kind of just kept the same paperwork, and they had waivers written in there, but then there was also some other things that were like, can't do this, but then you can do this. So it got a little confusing in my paperwork. So when I was supposed to get picked up to go to the, at the time it was called the Ranger Indoctrination Program, they were like, well, you're not able to do this. So they said no. So now I'm kind of stuck there at airborne school without a job. So I spent a couple weeks there waiting for a new job with the Army. And so they ended up sending me over to a medical support unit up at Fort Bragg. And while I was transferring from airborne school, which is at Fort Benning, Georgia, up to Fort Bragg for that, you know, they give you all your paperwork to transfer with you up there. And unfortunately, I wasn't the most reliable E4. I lost all my medical paperwork.
Oh, no.
So when I got up to Fort Bragg, I had to get it all fixed. So I got it fixed and then immediately applied for SF. And a couple months later, started the selection process for Special Forces.
You say you just joined or you saw the SF. I don't know. I have seen the signs around being personally in the military when I'm on the active duty posts and everything like that. I see signs up that says if you want to join, you know, call this number. I think some of the places usually have a climbing rope outside the building. But, like, what made you decide to do that? Like, it's – did you see one of the signs or did somebody approach you? Or and then I guess ultimately, you know, what made you decide to do it?
What helped make me decide to do it was just looking for a challenge, trying to find a unit of like-minded individuals. All the units in the military have great people. Everybody's doing great work. I was just some part of me just kind of wanted that next level challenge, like trying to find. I don't know. I kind of looking back, I think I was just naive enough to think maybe I could be good at something like that. So just wanted to see and challenge myself. And it was something, if I didn't try, I would have always questioned, like, could I have done those things? So yeah, I think it's a mixture of not quite knowing what I was getting into, getting suckered in by a few brochures and, you know, watching movies a little too much maybe, and just all of it kind of coalesced into me just walking into the recruiter's office and applying. So I did that. It was probably August, September of 2003. And then by January 2004, I was at selection for the Special Forces.
Going through the process of that selection process and then finally getting into the training, is there... Because I've always heard the individuals that go, it's never one type of person. It's always a mixture of the qualities, both mental and physical, to get through the process. And so is there, if somebody's considering to join the Special Forces, do you have any type of like wisdom or something to pass on to them?
That is one of the great things about SF is it does pull in an incredible wide variety of people. There's no, you know, one type of personality. You could say, oh, that guy's definitely going to make it. The only thing that definitely does kind of bring everybody together is, you know, that desire to be there, that desire to help the team, and just the inability to quit. I think that's the biggest thing. If you go out to selection, you'll see just people, you're like, oh, 100%, that guy's a physical specimen. He's going to make it, no questions asked. And then things get hard and you get tired and hungry and, you know, a nice warm bed and a good meal sounds a little better than going through that. And, you know, so I think I think the SF selection process does a great job of finding that and helping you find that in yourself. I think it would be needless bravado if I was like, oh, I never felt like quitting. Of course it did. A lot of that stuff was just miserable.
Right.
But I wasn't going to do it. And they were going to have to drag me out of there. And I think that's what they definitely do a good job of finding or helping you find in yourself as well.
Were you still a medic?
I did start the Army as a medic. When you switch over to Special Forces, you can switch over to any one of the four jobs on the enlisted side. I volunteered to continue to be a medic, and they selected me for that. It's not necessarily a guarantee that you do that, but I wanted to be, and if you already were and you kind of want to continue that.
Of course.
They do offer that.
Okay.
Generally.
Kind of moving forward, and I don't want to minimize any of your efforts prior to this event, but one of the reasons why we wanted you to have on the show is because you were recently awarded the Medal of Honor for your actions in April 6, 2008 in Shock Valley, Afghanistan. I don't want to go – I would like to let, if you don't mind, talk through it because I think it's important for the listeners to kind of understand it from your perspective about what happened. Thought it was important to be able to bring that up and to kind of chat about that before we kind of move into your time with the Secret Service.
Yeah. April 6th, 2008, we were working with the Afghan commandos in eastern Afghanistan. It was, we'd done many missions looking for high-value targets. It, in a lot of ways, should have been just another mission, but honestly, even from the team perspective going into it, we
didn't get the warm and fuzzy.
It was one of those days where you just don't get that warm and fuzzy about it, but this is the mission, this is the day. Okay, we're well trained, we're equipped, we're ready to go do this. So like I said, it just kind of like a normal day for us. We in SF, our primary job is to work with local partners to help them secure their own country. So that was our job that day, to take the Afghan commandos in there to look for the high value target for that day. And so we air infilled in via Blackhawks and Chinooks right as we got to the objective that day. Like I said, you didn't have a great feeling going in, and then even just starting at the helicopter that day, it didn't seem to be lining up quite right. So I was the first person on the helicopter, so that'd be the last person off of the Chinook that I was on. And last person off is just making sure everybody's off, everybody's safe, all the gear got off, nothing got left behind, because people get a little excited sometimes getting off the helicopter. And when you're getting off a Chinook, it should only take a few seconds to get off. You want to get that helicopter out of there as quickly as possible, because it's a big target just sitting there on any objective. Even if it's nobody's shooting at you, somebody's definitely looking at it. First moment we got there, I'm just remembering it's taking forever to get off that helicopter, and I really can't see. All I'm doing is staring at the back of 30 other heads trying to get off this helicopter. And so yelling at people, hurry up, get off this thing. I don't know why they're all slow today. And then as I kind of slowly approach the back of the helicopter, I notice that we're still hovering about 10 or 15 feet above the ground, as trying to get us as close to the ground as possible. But the riverbed that we're landing in is so rocky that they couldn't set down in it. So, of course, now I realize why everybody's taking their time getting off. So, like everybody else, I very slowly try and get off the helicopter so I don't break my leg jumping off that helicopter. So I kind of jump down into that riverbed. The helicopters all kind of fly away, and you're just taken back as you kind of look up at everything. And obviously we had seen imagery for where we were going, but imagery never quite gives you that real feel that you're going to have on the ground just for what the terrain actually looks like. You could see, okay, that's a hill or a mountain or whatever. But as soon as those helicopters flew away, it was just super cold, super quiet. And everywhere you looked, it was just basically straight up. and doesn't really make sense, but just kind of like looking up at the village, we could see the objective, and it was, yeah, it was just on top of a hill, looked like a little fortress, and I was like, well, that's not good. But yeah, that was the job. So we started working our way through the valley up to try and find some place where we could actually get up towards this village. So yeah, we're working our way through the valley and trying to find a way up towards the village. And I can see the lead element starting to work up kind of a terraced portion of the hill. I was in the trailing element as the only medic on the ground, so that way whatever might develop over the course of the day, I could kind of flex to wherever they might need me, you know, as the day went on, kind of get pulled into certain things. But yeah, that was the mindset, is that if I'm kind of in a trailing element, if we do make contact over here, I can flex over there. Okay. Or if we make contact over there, I can flex. So it gives me that ability. So we can see the lead element starting to work up, farming, if you can picture like a farming terraced cutouts in the mountain that the village had used. So I can see the lead element starting to go up there. As we just continue to approach, I distinctly remember seeing, at the time, just one guy dressed in blue run across the top of the hill. He was clearly holding a weapon, and I don't think that was some kind of key or anything, but just a few moments later, just everything kind of exploded on us. We started having small arms fire, sniper fire, machine gun, RPGs. Everything just starts coming down on us, feeling like from everywhere. Well, my job is, you know, to be a medic there. I'm also controlling an Afghan squad, so I get those guys to cover, start trying to figure out what's going on as we're hearing the radio calls.
You're saying that you're helping with the other Afghan soldiers do their maneuvers too, so you have the responsibility of trying to get them in place, just to clarify.
So each level, you not only have your SF mission, but you also have a mission to advise those guys. So you're wearing two hats at any given moment. So like for the captain on the team, he's advising the Afghan company commander to try and get him to coordinate his assets. But where we also have our backup communication. So if he's saying, hey, I need a squad to go over here, he's trying to get that commander to say it, but he's also talking to the SF guy to say, hey, we need to get these guys over here. So in SF, yeah, you're a medic, but your primary job is kind of a shooter first thing. Mm-hmm. I've kind of said it before, and it's a familiar thing. You know, the best medicine is superior firepower. So if we can you know, stay in control of this fight, then I don't have to fix too many people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, in my job, I was trying to make sure my commando squad was secure first, and then as I'm doing that job, I hear the first calls for medic from one of the nearby Afghan squads. So I kind of check with my squad, make sure they're secure for a second, and then run over to check on the first guy who was wounded. So start assessing that Afghan commando. Luckily, he wasn't too severely wounded. Kind of do a quick patch up on him. Tell him to get back in the fight because that's...
He can still pull the trigger.
That's what he needed to do at the time. I remember he was a saw gunner. Like, I need that saw to get back up running. So, yeah, you're fine. get back at it. But as I'm kind of finishing up with him and kind of looking back over the valley and just seeing everything that's going on, I remember watching an RPG come down from the hill and hit right next to one of our lines, one of the squads that set up. And within a second, I kind of knew who had been hurt, because one of my teammates, he would always, before every mission, he would go get his squad and he would bring them over to me, and he would say, if something happens to me, find Ron. and then he'd get the next guy. And if something happens to me, find Ron and just make sure every one of them kind of had a visual on this is Ron, find him. And so when I watched that RPG hit, I immediately hear calls for Ron. It's not Medic this time, but it's Ron. Come down. I was like, okay, I got to go. I got to go help his squad. So like I said, I kind of told that first wounder guy, hey, you're fine. Take care of yourself for a second. And we're very entwined with our Afghan interpreters in order to accomplish our mission over there. So I told the interpreter that I was working with on my squad, you know, just get the guys to hold in place for a minute. I'll be back. You know, things are still developing, but like I'll be back in a few minutes. And so I ran over to help my teammate who'd been hurt. Fortunately, he had received some shrapnel wounds to the neck, and also got a concussion from the blast because it had been so close. It's one of those, you know, very lucky wounds that it was that close and hit him where it did, but in the end, wasn't a bad day for him or me to try and fix. So as I was working on him, trying to get the bleeding in his neck stabilized, that's when I started hearing the radio calls from up on the mountain that multiple guys had been severely hurt. I thought at the time at least one person had been killed, and they needed me up there. So kind of again, it got to that point where like, okay, well, you're not that bad off.
I'm sure by this time and your experience at this point, just a visual assessment can kind of give you that idea. And that's kind of, I think, powerful in a sense that we're like, you see the individual on the ground and you immediately kind of have what's running in your head already. But then also, too, on top of that, to provide that triage, because now you're getting called back again for other places. So, I mean, it's amazing in that situation, like that much responsibility.
Yeah. I can't speak highly enough of the training you get to become a Special Forces Medic in 18 Delta. While the Q course as a whole to be a Special Forces Medic took 2 years, basically from when I started the Q course fully, June of 2004, and I graduated in May of 2006. So it was 23 months. That's going straight through, no injuries, no having to repeat any courses or anything. Like that's just what it took to go through there. And a year of that is just the medic course. And they do an amazing job of getting you to the point where you see something, you can fix it if it's an immediate, you know, life threat, you're quick, you're on it. And you know, the Green Beret medics out there are definitely the finest combat medics in the world. I just happened to be one for a while, but as a whole, they are, you know, amazing at their jobs, and they save so many lives. So I can't speak highly enough of what especially the guys are out there still doing it right now. But yeah, when you're actually on the ground doing it, and it's your friends, and it's your you know, your brothers in arms, and you know these guys, you know their wives, their girlfriends, their kids, you know all of that. It's definitely tough to, you know, have to make that call. Like, sorry, you just got shrapnel to the neck, but you're fine, buddy. I gotta go. So when we heard those calls to go, that they needed the help, you know, that just became the next priority for that day. And you know, packed up my stuff, started working my way up the hill. Our team sergeant and a couple of the other guys started coordinating some of the commando squads that were down in the valley to come up and help support as well. And you know, as we just started working our way up these terrace steps, now under heavy fire, we all just started battling our way up a hill for a while. I don't know how long it exactly took. So when we finally got up to where that lead element was pinned down, as you were saying, it just becomes that quick visual assessment. Okay, where can I be best utilized at this moment? I saw immediately one of our interpreters, just a quick look at him. He looked like he had been killed in action. So I just kind of had quickly moved on to the other guys. One had been shot multiple times, once in the arm, once in the pelvis. Another guy had been shot a couple times in the leg, and several other people had received some shrapnel wounds and other things. It was just kind of a mess up there between how many people were hurt and then how much space we actually had to put people or provide any cover or anything for these guys who are hurt. But yeah, I just take those couple of quick seconds, like, okay, well, I think this is the biggest priority. And so I started working on the guy who'd been shot in the pelvis first. And, well, I tell this story now. It's all kind of remember how things went, but it's also kind of a jumble because I know I did this and I know I did that, but it's all...
That's what I was going to say. I mean, in that moment, I'm sure it was just you were focused on the task at hand. I mean, you weren't really... You can't argue that you were looking at a clock. You were doing your job and making sure everybody was safe.
Yeah. Definitely trying to find that balance of keeping on everything, but doing, you know, these... Some of the tasks that, you know, you have to do sometimes get very delicate, very minute and as you're doing them. But I mean, that's the job. So I started working on the first guy. You know, his injury was his arm wasn't very big, but his pelvic wound, unfortunately, as soon as you kind of know anything has damaged the pelvis, you know, your medic brain just starts dumping all this info, like, okay, if he damages pelvis, that's this much bleeding I have to account for, whether I can see it or not. If it damaged other things, I have to account for all of this.
And that's what I was trying to refer to back before, and maybe it didn't come out as clear as I was thinking, because I was just thinking because you know, in the sense, like, that's what I was kind of describing, is that, and maybe it only comes to medics when they go through the training and just in general, both military, civilian, is that you see, you're assessing the situation, and now you're dealing with that flooding of information of, like, I've identified it, I see it, there's bullets flying by me. Everybody else is asking for my attention, but now I know what's going on here. And so that's kind of what I was trying to describe in that aspect.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that. Like, you know, he's describing to me, my leg doesn't feel straight, and I can see where his leg is. I'm like, your leg's straight. So now I'm like, okay, where this bullet hit, it definitely damaged some bone in there. And I don't have an x-ray machine, but I got to start doing that math in my head. Like, if it did this bone, he lost this much blood. If it did this bone, it lost that much blood, whether I see it or not. So when I was actually working on him for a brief moment, I had to see, you know, what damage had been done. Like, I could see the entry wound, but I couldn't see an exit wound. So I had to find that, but I don't want to move him any more than I possibly had. So, you know, I ended up taking off my helmet for a minute there so I could basically lie my head on the ground as close as possible, just roll him the minimum I could, see what I could see, and then put him back. And of course, put my helmet back on because there's bullets flying everywhere. But so, you know, with his wound, yeah, I really couldn't get pressure on it very well, just as high up as it was. It's not something you could put a tourniquet on and, you know, just, you know, I've saved the day there. So at one point over the course of the day, I just made the call, like, I have to try and get some kind of control on this, but I don't want to just smash his broken bones any more than I have to. So I ended up using one of the hemostatic agents that we had. It's something that helps cause blood clots faster to help stop that bleeding. But the wound was so small, it's not something you can just see, hey, that's what's bleeding, I can put pressure on that. So I ended up basically, at the time it was a powder form, so I was pouring that on what I could see, and then with my fingers just kind of shoving that into his wound, trying to hopefully find whatever is bleeding in there to stop. And, you know, it just got to the point where that's the best answer I could think of at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of was repeating that over and over again and then bandaged that to hopefully stabilize what's going on in there as best I could. While all of this is kind of going on, like I said earlier, I knew just from the first look that our interpreter was killed in action. But I still owed it to him to,
of course,
when you had that just brief moment, like, I got to go actually check on him and just make sure. Because if I don't know what killed him, I can't be 100% sure he's,
sure,
he's actually dead. So I went over, checked him, found he'd been shot in the head. It was a non-survivable wound. So go back to the small piece of terrain I was trying to keep the wounded guys on. And he said this whole time, like, just more guys are getting shrapnel wounds or just other things are just building up on us. Yeah, while we did lose CK at that time, there were some other ones around. Unfortunately, they were collecting injuries as well. So, yeah, we didn't lose our ability to,
okay,
communicate completely. And luckily, there are those kind of universal hand and arm signals that we all learn in basic training. We're trying to, you know, that's one of the jobs to teach them. So even if you don't have that guy, like, just get cover and shoot that way. Everybody can kind of understand that, whether you have the interpreter or not. It's the more nuanced stuff. You definitely need those guys, and they're invaluable in that respect. But yeah, we did have some other ones up there who were still able to help us. And so, like I mentioned, the team sergeant who was initially down in the valley with me, he'd come up, and he was starting to try and coordinate getting people out of there, because it was just not a position we could hold for a long period of time. There's not enough space, not enough anything. So he's kind of coordinating, bringing people back into the area. Like I said, we're just continuing to get more casualties. Around that time, we had another Afghan get shot in the head, and, you know, the way he dropped, it was like, okay, well, that guy's dead, but, you know, check on him a little bit later. And like, no, he's not. He just got really lucky with the way the bullet kind of hit him in the head and rolled around his helmet and messed him up, but it didn't.
He survived it?
Didn't kill him. And it's just the weird things bullets do sometimes. But we're just continuing to get stuff, you know, collect casualties. So we bring down a squad to try and start moving guys. And another one of the Americans at that time, he gets shot in the leg. He gets a traumatic amputation of a leg. So, you know, just through the way things were, like, I'm kind of pinned down somewhere. So I'm trying to make sure they're getting tourniquet on him. And one of the guys was over there to help with that. And a few moments later, a couple minutes later, I'm not sure, our team sergeant, he gets shot for the first time in his chest plate. And so I go out to check on him, and he seems okay as you can be at the time, having just been shot there. So I go back to keep working on some of the guys who are a little more severely hurt. And so it was around this time, I know I'm working on the soldier who'd been shot in the pelvis and in the arm. And that's when the team sergeant kind of turns towards us, and he's trying to tell us something. And he ends up getting shot in the left arm, and simultaneously I get hit. So we figure the bullet went through his arm and then hit me.
Oh, wow.
In the helmet. So I remember, you know, at this point, I have treated so many different people. I have kind of just blood everywhere, unfortunately, on me. So I'm trying to check myself, like, feel around, like, am I bleeding? Am I, what? I don't know. And I'm just, like, asking the guy I'm working on, like, am I okay? Like, I don't know what happened. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, he kind of tells me, yeah, you're okay. So I grab a tourniquet, run out to where the team sergeant had just been shot, put a tourniquet on him, try and get him to, you know, our ever decreasing cover that we can put these guys. Luckily, just given his wound, his very severe wound, but he's the only ambulatory patient we have at the time, like somebody who can actually move. So
mm-hmm.
he kind of self-evacuates down the hill, down those terrace to where some of the other guys were still fighting. So they kind of were able to help him go down that way. And like I said, we're just continuing to collect casualties. The enemy at a certain point around there had actually maneuvered into a building that was probably 30, 40 meters above us, like up the hill. But luckily it was just kind of inset just enough. And so they were trying to start shooting down at us from there, where we really didn't have any cover at all from that. We ended up, you know, dropping some bombs on that building, which then just causes more
attention
issues, yeah, because we have all this building starting to drop on us. So I'm trying to cover the patients as best I can, trying to keep things to
right.
Keep things to a minimum, stuff that I have to fix, because, you know, every guy kind of brings a little first aid kit on him, mm-hmm, and I have my aid bag, which has a lot more stuff. But as you start to get so many casualties, I just, you know, things get to the point where if that's not going to kill you, there's only so much I can do for you, mm-hmm, at that point. So we're, yeah, just continuing to collect those guys. And then one of the other team guys ends up finding a different way down the hill. It's way steeper than what we'd come up. It's not good at all. I think I remember him saying at one point, like, they probably won't die if we take the casualties that way. Like, probably won't is better than probably will, which was our option the other way. So it made sense. So we ended up grabbing some 2x9 kind of like ropes to wrap around the casualties' shoulders so we could start to lower them down. These, you know, some of the drops were short, some of the drops were up to like 20 feet or so. So you're basically trying to like lower them down to the guy down on the next level so you can kind of catch them, and just repeating this down the hill to where it leveled out, and then start to create another casualty collection point down there. And so, you know, that became the next objective. Okay, this guy, you know, I double check all his bandages, make sure everything's good, send him down, double check the next guy, work him down, and just keep repeating that for all the wounded guys who could help themselves down, couldn't help themselves down, starting to get everybody off the whole time, you know, continuing to be shot at, continuing to shoot back as you can. And, you know, as we get back down the bottom of the valley, okay, got to go through reassessments of everybody again, get everybody ready to go. It was sometime around there the first helicopter came in. I don't even think it wasn't really a medevac. It was just a helicopter was in the air supporting us. They knew we had a lot of casualties. They volunteered to come into a very hot LZ and threw a bunch of people on there. The next helicopter volunteered to come in again. Super hot LZ. I mean, yeah, they were taking rounds. I think one of the pilots ended up getting shot while he was flying in. Everybody was, you know, just constantly under fire because, you know, while our primary objective was on this one side of the valley, there was another part of the village on the other side of the valley, and there was supposed to be a team that kind of was to go up there, but they physically couldn't get up there. The fire was too bad, so nobody could get over there. So we're kind of being shot at from both sides of the valley, so there's really nowhere to hide. But luckily, between the Army helicopters and the Air Force platforms that were supporting us that day, they did an amazing job trying to keep that fire to a minimum as best they could. I mean, it was constant and intense, and, you know, but they did a great job. And our combat controller that day, he ended up getting the Air Force Cross, which is the second highest award for valor you can get, and earned every bit of that in my mind, calling in fire from, you know, just a few feet away from where I was doing all that work. He was pinned down just like all of us, but still calling in that fire despite being hit in the leg himself during that fight. But it was when we were down there in the valley and trying to put these guys on the helicopters, it was at that point I kind of realized like my left arm was hurting, and, you know, you just kind of shake it out, I look at my arm, I'm sure it's fine, just move on about my day. It wasn't until we actually got back to base later in the day. And we got back to base after they made the call to leave the objective. So we, you know, we'd got all the wounded guys out. We, you know, a bunch of guys were just walking wounded, getting back to the helicopters. But yeah, when we got back to base and after checking on the wounded guys and make sure everybody was good, you know, I went back to take a shower after, get cleaned up. And so I noticed I had a cut on my arm, bruising. And I was like, I didn't have that before. So I went and grabbed my uniform, ended up finding a bullet hole in it. And I was like, okay, at some point I was shot in the arm. I don't remember when.
It's pretty hardcore.
I was just
sorry.
Busy. So, you know, just kind of caught me off guard there. But so in the end of the day, I mean, we had, you know, 4 critical U.S. casualties. There was 3 more of us who were wounded in some way, about a dozen or so between the Afghan commandos and the interpreters wounded or killed. And then there was just so many other close calls. Like, as everybody gets back, you start looking at your stuff and, okay, oh, that guy, he had the tip of his barrel shot off. Oh, this guy, as he's taking off his kit, he finds that the camelback he'd had on his back, he'd been shot through the camelback. It just, you know, gone through. It didn't hit him in a way he realized, but, you know, he'd been shot. And it's, everybody had those, you know, like game of inches, just a little bit different here, and it would have been a very different day for us.
And so through that whole experience, what do you think just kept you going?
What kept me going the whole time was just fear of letting my guys down. I was the medic on the ground, and I know all these guys. I spend more time with them than I do my family between train ups for deployments and then deployments. At the time, we were doing basically 7 months on, 7 months off on deployments. So, you know, you literally are spending more time with them, and, you know, as you're seeing them get hurt, it doesn't matter if you like them or don't like them or whatever. It's a brotherhood. They are family. I was an only child growing up, so I can only assume. But they are same as blood to me. I owed them everything I could do that day, and, you know, for quite a while, it was just like, you know, did I do enough? Did I do everything I could? And, you know, it got down to the point where, okay, the only guys that died that day both had non-survivable wounds. One of our Afghan commandos had been shot just below the chest plate, and it hit either his vena cava or his aorta. It doesn't much matter which one it hit. It's not survivable out there in the field. But luckily, everybody else who could make it did.
Well, I want to say that I think everybody in the room here, but just extremely fortunate to be able to hear that story, and thank you for sharing it. I know it could be extremely difficult maybe at times to be able to share that. You probably hear it a lot, but just in earnest, I just want to say thank you for what you've done and what you did for the Army and for the American people.
Well, thank you. And when you say it's hard to talk about, before the medal, I think I probably only shared the story with a handful of people ever. It was a day. I did my job. Hoped I did it well. I thought I did it well, but since getting the medal and getting the Medal of Honor, and that kind of in a lot of ways brings a weight of responsibility with it. And like, now I don't try and tell the story as like, oh, look at all these cool things I did. I was, you know, we shot this guy and I was super brave and did this. Like, I was scared the whole time, honestly. I just, you know, continued to do it because I owed that to the guys. And I like to share the story now because, you know, there's so many military people out there right now who are still overseas, still fighting for this country, and they're doing it quietly. They're not bragging about it. They're not talking about it. They just go out and get their job done. And if I can share my story, it gives the American public a small glimpse of what people are out there still doing every day. And I think that's important.
So again, sir, I don't want to minimize the events that took place that day, but when you finished up with that mission, what does that look like for your group? Are you what does that transition look? Do you get patched up, get refitted, and you move on to the next mission? Or is it something that if something like that happens, do you get some leave and then move on to the mission? Or can you explain kind of what happens after an event like that?
Oh, obviously, our wounded guys, the severely wounded guys, went back to the States to get the care they needed. The more moderately wounded of us just kind of got treated in place. And, you know, it was as rough as it was, as we were down in manpower, obviously, to take, you know, four severe casualties. But an SF team, generally speaking, is, you know, it's designed to be 12 guys. So four guys getting evac, you can do the math. That's a third of us. But that doesn't change the mission. We still were responsible to get that Afghan commando unit back out there, back defending their country. So we still did. We did at least one more big mission. I don't know if we did a couple other small ones, but we were back out there. We did end up getting to the point where we had to plus up with another team support to be able to effectively do the job, just because, you know, we were running out of bodies. But yeah, it didn't stop us. We went back out there, continued to do the mission. And I just chuckle. Another mission we were on a couple weeks after the. Our interpreters, which we mentioned before, they would sometimes have walkie-talkie conversations with the bad guys when we're on objectives. And, you know, it's just, we're going to get you. Obviously a little less polite than that. And at one point on a future mission, they were like, oh, these are the guys we messed up a few weeks ago. And then one of the other enemy was like, they kind of messed us up a little more than we got them. So actually, as that fight kind of just started to get a little interesting, they all kind of stopped and went away just because of a little smack talk from our interpreters. but yeah, it didn't stop anything for us. Yeah, you miss those guys, you care about them, you're talking to them back in the rear, but the mission continued.
Well, again, thank you for sharing that. Like, how long did you continue to serve with the Army? When did you actually transition out?
So I got the Medal of Honor for actions on my second deployment. We got back from that deployment, just the normal rotation, in mid-May, so about a month, 6 weeks later. And then I had about a year left to go in the Army at that point. So May of 2009 is when I ended up separating from the Army. And so as I was getting to the point where I was looking for what to do next, federal law enforcement just kind of clicked in my head for some reason. Probably, I don't know, grew up watching my dad. My dad, you know, he was in the Air Force, but he was OSI, Office of Special Investigations over there. So they're law enforcement as well. So maybe it was growing up watching that. But so I ended up kind of shotgun blasting a bunch of the federal law enforcement agencies, the FBI, Secret Service, DEA, marshals, air marshals, everybody. And not to chalk up the Secret Service, because I'm in the Secret Service now, but honestly, I just clicked with all the people in the Secret Service very quickly. I loved the personality that came with the agency, and this was the one I kind of quickly hoped I was going to get into. And after I got out of the Army in May, had a couple months down. In August, I got the call and started in September of 2009 with the Secret Service.
And where was your first field office?
My first field office was Phoenix.
Okay. And so I guess from your time in Phoenix, did you go into phase two? Because I know at the time you're currently in the counter-assault team. Was that something that you went from Phoenix to, or did you go to a protection detail?
The getting with the counter-assault team was basically the goal.
Oh, okay.
From when I joined in with the Secret Service.
Well, was that something that you read about in through a recruiter? Did you learn that through a recruiter, or did you once you came in, you heard about it?
You know, honestly, I don't know exactly where I first heard about it or what kind of connected me with that. But I remember doing my first interviews with the Secret Service, getting hired out of the Raleigh office, and talking, hey, this is where I want to end up once I do get there, and kind of asking them, how do I get over to the counter-assault team? Because I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was definitely a goal from the very beginning. And so as soon as I could put my hand up for the counter-assault team, I did, and basically moved over as quickly as I could. Not that I didn't enjoy my time in Phoenix, but it was just, I don't know, I think I had that, a lot of that military mentality, like what's the next job, what's the next mission, what's this, and so I was excited to transition over and you know, been with the counter-assault team now about 5 years. And
is it about this time that you actually, like, you get the call for receiving the Medal of Honor, like the notification for it?
Yeah. So last August, so that'd be August of 2018, I got a weird call on my home phone, of all things. And somebody was left me a message, and they were telling me, I'm so-and-so from the Pentagon. I'm looking for Ron Scher. Need you to call me back. So it was a weird call, and called them back, and, you know, being here in D.C. and being a criminal investigator, you have all those, like, what kind of scam is going on feelings. So they go through the process of telling me somebody needs to talk to you about something, and they won't tell me who, they won't tell me what. So that just...
It has to be a fun call.
It still seems so weird. So I was like, I'm sure you are who you say you are, but I have no idea. Would you mind, if you're in the military, send me an email from your Army email to my Secret Service email. Let's just, verify this in some way. And so they did, and, it turns out they did work for the Pentagon. So what we kind of go through that process of, they're like, okay, we need to set up a call from this person. They just kept telling me a high-ranking DOD official needs to talk to you about something. And so we ended up setting the date for the call. And so date comes, that morning I end up getting kind of my first pre-call from the military. They're like, hey, we're just doing a comms check. Everything's good. You're ready for your call? Like, yeah, I'm ready for my call. And then a little bit later, ATSAC over CAT ends up checking in, and he's like, hey, Ron, are you good for a call? And I'm like, yeah, I'm good for my call. Why are you asking me about my call? I'm very confused why you're asking me about this. And he's like, I don't worry about it. So we kind of do a couple more comms checks. People are checking, you're good for your call. Yes, I'm good for that. And then the boss ended up calling me back again, and he's like, your call's canceled. Why are you canceling my call from the Army? Again, he kind of is like, don't worry about it. So a little bit later, they end up calling me again. They're like, Ron, would you and your wife mind coming to the East Wing, or not the East Wing, the Eisenhower Executive Building? You need to talk to the supervisor from the president's detail. I'm like, well, that's weird. Especially they wanted her to come along. So at that point, you're definitely trying to process, like, why is the Army calling on the Secret Service? And so we're trying to run any scenario we could through our head, trying to explain what was going on. But it kind of just got to the point where you're like, well, let's just go along for the ride. I can't think of a legitimate reason why these people are doing this. So we end up going over to the Eisenhower Building and hanging out with the, like I said, the supervisor of the president's detail. And he ends up telling us that the chief of staff at the time, John Kelly, wants to speak with me. We're kind of like, okay, well, at least there's some kind of military tie. Like, John Kelly was a former general in the Marine Corps. The Army had been calling me. And so at this point, we're like, still at no point thinking anything about the Medal of Honor. quietly whispering, my wife and I, like, maybe I'm getting upgraded to the Distinguished Service Cross, which would, you know, have been an amazing honor. It's the, you know, the second highest award. It's a huge thing. So we're kind of like just like winking and like maybe that's what's going to be. So they end up bringing us over to the West Wing, kind of having us wait there for a few more minutes. And then Mr. Kelly, General Kelly, comes over and he's like, hey, Ron, you know, just want to talk to you for a few minutes. If you want to come back to my office. And so we kind of go from that little waiting room and he's taking us back to his office. And, you know, having been on the counter assault team, being very familiar with the White House, you know, in my head, I'm like, well, sir, your office is back that way, but you're the chief of staff. I'll follow you wherever it is you want to go. And so he kind of leads us around and then he took that left turn into the Oval Office. And as soon as I kind of broke that corner, I see the president sitting at the at the desk. There's some of the White House photographers set up on what was my left side. I hear them clicking away. And at the point, I definitely had the uh-oh moment. And you know, the president got up, shook her hands, was like, but you didn't expect to see me today. And I was like, no, sir, did not. And yeah, he kind of thanked me for my service. And at that point told me that he'd approve me for the Congressional Medal of Honor. And it was definitely a completely overwhelming moment hearing that.
Not bad.
Being an outsider, you know, before, like, I had heard, like, people sometimes, like, no, hey, I got put in for this, or you heard people are being talked about it, but I hadn't heard anything about it. I knew that there was a military-wide review of Silver Stars and Distinguished Service Crosses to see if they'd been properly awarded. I knew that, but at no point did I associate my Silver Star with that process. So yeah, when he told us that, it was just a completely overwhelming moment, and it was definitely sometimes good to be in the Secret Service because, you know, since I had the White House pass and the clearance to be in there, they were able to coordinate all that and make it that little extra special. Yeah, that's kind of how we found out, and they told us, I think it was, that was September 4th of 2018, and they quickly scheduled a presentation for August or October 1st, and it's kind of been a whirlwind since then. The medal definitely comes with a level of responsibility. I think it's all self-imposed on the guys who do receive it. I mean, it's such a small group. Like right now, there's 71 living recipients in the country. So when you think of, like, I mean, there's approximately 17 million veterans in the country, and 71 of them have this medal. I don't want to speak for everyone, but I think almost every one of them kind of views that as, you know, responsibility to just represent not only those guys who are still serving, but to, you know, highlight those guys who didn't come home, because there's just no way that, you know, I, Ron Scher, could say I gave anything compared to those guys. I mean, they're the heroes, the ones who pay the ultimate sacrifice out there. So yeah, while it does come with a level of responsibility, it's just a huge honor to get to have whatever level of platform this is to get to acknowledge those guys and to get to, you know, speak to veterans. I mean, some of my, you know, funnest times are just going out to military bases and just getting to hang out with, you know, active duty or reserves or guard, and, you know, get to have some shared experiences with them. It's just a huge honor. And it took a little while to kind of, I don't think I'll ever fully be comfortable with that role, but, you know, just to get to to see what it means to the troops who are out there. It's just very touching, and anytime I can support what the military is still doing, I definitely love to take that opportunity because they're doing amazing things out there, like I've said. And yeah, it's not an experience I was expecting to have, just a year ago. I mean, just a couple weeks from now, those first calls started a year ago. Mm. And so it's been quite a transition since then, but it's been a humbling but amazing honor.
And so do you have something for the listeners, for those that are still serving, and for the Secret Service? Do you have any, do you have a message for them, or do you have a message to share?
Well, like I've said, to everybody who's still out there in the military, still doing the job, I'm proud to have ever been a part of that organization. Just to have played a small role in the history of the military and the service to this country is an honor, and I think everybody in this country at some level would benefit from finding some way to serve something that's bigger than themselves at whatever level that is, whether it's military service or law enforcement or just helping out in their community on trash pickup days. I don't know. I think everybody should find some level of that. And I've been very fortunate to have that service in the military and now with the Secret Service, where I can continue to serve. And my wife likes to say I keep trying to find jobs where it's my job to do really cool things but not not get talked about, and that all kind of fell apart when they gave me the Medal of Honor. But that's just been a great experience for me to get to serve with the quiet professionals in the military, and now the Secret Service. We can have our same kind of taglines, like standing on the sidelines of history, and just different things like that. And it's been quite an adventure, and I'm every day I still love getting to work with this agency. And while they don't let me out of the cat operations section much anymore, I just get to send emails now, it's still good to be close to the team and still get to play some role in that.
Well, on behalf of all the people that work with Standing Post, I just want to say thank you for taking your time to come in and speak to us and be able to share that amazing story, and to hear it through your words as far as the actions that took place that day. So thank you very much.
Oh, definitely my pleasure. Getting anything the Secret Service needs from me, I'm here to help.